Garda, me on Kjolaris Nashunta, the National Concert Hall, be a hall of enchantment, an inspiration, and a lasting joy to all who come here. May success, unlimited, adorn its every endeavour. It now gives me very great pleasure to declare it open.
Fitzwilliam Square, Wednesday, May the 10th, 1865. Dear Martin, how are your mamma and papa? I hope you are all well. Your Uncle George had a slight cold, but the recent weather has made him feel much better, and he's his old self again, thank God. It was most fortunate indeed, as we have had a very busy time over the last few days with the opening of the exhibition. It was a great pity you could not be in Dublin, as, knowing your love of music, you could have joined us for such a wonderful concert yesterday afternoon. The whole city has been in a turmoil since Monday, when the Prince of Wales arrived at Kingstown. There was a magnificent ball at the Mansion House, and many people did not get to their beds until a very late hour. However, we kept our strength for the official opening, and it was an exhausting but wonderful event. People were crowding into the exhibition buildings in Earlsford Terrace from an early hour. The company which has organised the exhibition has constructed wonderful halls in Coburg Gardens with a magnificent winter garden made of glass, which is 500 feet in length. We went to the magnificent concert hall, and by noon the balustrades of the galleries were crowded by ladies in their finest dresses. There were many false alarms, but just a few minutes after 2 o'clock the Prince of Wales arrived, looking a deal stouter than he did on his last visit, I fear. The lights flashed on the bayonets of the 78th Highlanders as they presented arms, and you could hardly hear yourself think with the cheers and the sound of the orchestra. Mr. Gilbert Sanders, the chairman of the organising company, made a most impressive address to the assembled crowd, which must have numbered many thousands.
The building in which we are now assembled owes its origins to a desire to supply a want which long existed in this city, that is, of a structure where the citizens might enjoy rational recreation combined with the elevating influences of the arts. A tract of about 17 acres in extent, formerly known as the Coburg Gardens, having passed into the possession of Mr. Benjamin Lee Guinness, that gentleman, with his characteristic liberality in the promotion of all that can add to the comfort and happiness of his fellow citizens, placed the land at the disposal of the newly formed company at the price for which he had purchased it. The design of Mr. Alfred Jones was selected as the best calculator to meet the requirements of the company. The first stone was laid in March 1863.
The programme of music was most appropriate to the occasion, and as performed by the band and choruses, of which there must have been over 1,000, under the baton of my favourite conductor, Mr. Joseph Robinson, made an extremely fine effect. After the national anthem, we were treated to the old 100th, which was exceedingly well delivered. Ceremonial key had been presented to the prince, Handel's coronation anthem was performed, followed by the opening chorus of Mendelssohn's Lobgesang and The Heavens Are Telling from the Creation. You would have loved all this music, I know, but the final piece was truly festive. The Hallelujah Chorus, I have never heard it so admirably given. At the climax, Mr. Robinson brought in the wonderful drum, which came specially from Mr. Distin of London. It is said to be the largest in the world, measuring 8 feet across and made of buffalo skin. It added a tremendous clamour to the music.
Alleluia, 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 Alleluia. The event provided Dublin with an important asset, a concert hall. And long after the exhibition was closed, the hall continued to be an important musical venue. In the late 1870s, the Coburg Gardens complex had come into the possession of the government and were passed to the Royal University. Dr. John Larcher remembered one concert held there very clearly indeed.
It was after having a lesson with the Esposito myself, I was introduced to Harty. I met him for the very first time. And Harty had got the prize for his Irish symphony at the Festspiele.
Yes.
And he wanted somebody to strike a most important note on the gong. And Esposito said, here's your man.
Yes.
So we said goodbye to Esposito, and I went up to the Royal University Concert Hall, and Harty showed me the score. It was in the last movement. Now he said, this is most important. I'll give you the cue, and you must give a good hard blow. So we tried all the different ways of doing the blow, and Harty was quite satisfied. Now he said, this is the breaking of a spell.
Yes.
So it's very important. So I arrived in due course for the concert, and I may have played in other things, I've forgotten now really, but when this moment came, for the gong, I took flight and didn't strike.
And the spell remained unbroken.
And the spell remained unbroken. Well, all I have to say is I didn't say goodbye to Harty that evening. I slunk home like a man who'd committed his murder.
But the hall's days as a concert venue were numbered as it took on a new role in the academic life in Ireland. Michael O'Doherty, project architect from the Board of Works.
Around 1908, it came into the hands of the National University. Prior to that, the Royal University moved in, adapted it as a university. 1908, the National University was set up, and they adapted it even further. Around 1914, they decided that they would rebuild the entire block, and in fact demolished half, the front half of the buildings, and then built a completely new block along the front. The idea was at that stage, I think, to eventually demolish the remainder of the buildings and continue this extension around the hallway. But I think the war interrupted at that stage, and it was stopped at that.
So the facade we all know for so long in Nursery Terrace is a relatively modern addition to the original plan.
Yeah, that was built in 1914. Well, the Royal Tennis Courts, of course, are still there. They're being used at present by the university, I think, as some studios. The archery grounds and the old Sculpture Avenue still exists, with the great waterfall at one end, which relates to the sculpture hall within the building. There was a very clever, very lovely link-up between the gardens and the exhibition buildings.
The fortunes of the hall were to fall very low indeed over the next 40 years. Richie Ryan recalls the state of the building when he was a student.
One critic complained when we made our announcement that it was like putting a patch on old clothing. But of course, there are many impressive dresses today which are quite old. When I was a university student in the late 40s and early 50s, this building was so derelict that it wasn't used at all, even for examination purposes. It was used for the storage of turf, and pigeons were flying in and out of the building, and students weren't allowed to go into it because it was regarded that the glass in the roof and that was dangerous. And I've also a recollection then that when it was restored, partly restored for the purpose of dealing with the overcrowding of the university, that it was proposed to have a symphony concert in the hall. But again, that was abandoned because of some anxieties at that stage. So you can imagine the anxiety which I, as minister several years later, had when the suggestion was made that maybe this hall could be converted to its previous use. But we had a thorough examination made at that time and found, in fact, that it wasn't, in fact, feasible, and I think this has been proved in the event.
If the hall was to lie dormant for three quarters of a century, the other main theme in our story, that of its resident orchestra, was only beginning. 2RN, the Dublin broadcasting station, was launched in January 1926. An orchestra was an early acquisition and was led by Terry O'Connor, who happily was among the audience at the state opening of the new hall. When a shortwave service was planned in 1946, the whole musical side was reorganised and two groups were set up, a Radio Éireann Symphony Orchestra of 62 players and a light orchestra of 22. The Phoenix Hall became the new symphony's home. Although too small to be a proper concert hall, it made an excellent broadcasting studio. Here's part of a recording made there of Daniel McNulty's Divertimento.
Well, I think in our own case it's more complicated, perhaps because of the history of orchestral music in Ireland. It didn't grow in its recent times from a background of professional concert giving. It grew really from broadcasting.
Dr. Gerard Victory, Director of Music.
And therefore, in a way, the cart is before the horse. In the old days when Ireland hadn't got really professional orchestras, there was a lot of concert giving. By the time broadcasting grew, and with it a full symphony orchestra, we were then in the position that a broadcast studio, initially its home, had to expand, as it were, into a definitive concert hall where the public in large numbers could also hear it live. This made tentative steps in the early days of the 40s and 50s in the Phoenix Hall, which was really a good recording studio where the public were allowed in. And that, unfortunately, was taken over at a later stage by the Department of Posts and Telegraphs as a telephone exchange. And we had to move to various halls, Francis Xavier Hall and indeed others, none of which were, if you like, ideal concert halls. They became recording studios with larger and larger numbers of people wanting to get in and sometimes going to the Gaiety Theatre where we had more prestigious concerts. And all of this diverse activity meant there was no central place with first-class facilities for both public and orchestra where they could work and develop not just broadcasting only, but living the full life, as it were, and conveying it to continually changing audiences, live listening to them in the proper surroundings.
Dr. Olive Smith recalls how another important part of our story got underway.
Well, it started from the formation of the Music Association of Ireland in 1948, when, as one of our objects, was to have a concert hall for Dublin. In 1951, I think it was early, a concert hall committee was formed, and we worked for a bit and realised that a committee really couldn't do anything serious. And in January 1952, Concert and Assembly Hall Limited was incorporated, with A.P. Reynolds as chairman and Edgar Deal from the Music Association and myself, and there was Dr. Larshey and later on Sir Alfred Byte and Lord Moyne, and gradually it grew and expanded. And we spent from that for 7 or 8 years hunting for a site. Without really getting one, finally. But by this time, it was obvious that we'd really got to do something and hoped that a site would turn up. And it was decided that we would run this big concert in the Theatre Royal, I expect you remember, in January 1960. Now, this was really due to Tibor Paul. He wanted to get something going, and so he arranged that we should do this. The orchestra very, very generously gave their services free, and we brought over Gioconda De Vita to play the, I think it was the Brahms violin concerto she played. And there was a great to-do about it. And we had a tremendous audience. And that was the sort of launching of the campaign.
One of Concert and Assembly Hall Limited's most prestigious undertakings was a Beethoven festival at the Olympia Theatre, which included all the symphonies and concertos. Charles Lynch and part of the Beethoven Fourth Piano Concerto with the Radio Erin Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Tibor Paul. It was the tragic death of John F. Kennedy which started the next chapter, as Mervyn Wall, then Secretary of the Arts Council, explains.
After President Kennedy had been assassinated, the Arts Council were asked by the government to suggest a suitable memorial. Now, we understood at the time that the government had in mind something like a statue at the corner of College Street and Pierce Street on the site of the previous Crampton Memorial, which had been removed because it was in an unsafe state. Now, the Arts Council recommended the building of a concert hall, very much needed in Dublin, of course. I attended a meeting of a body called Concert and Assembly Hall Limited, which was made up of very dedicated people who had managed to collect £2,000 for the purpose. The Arts Council calculated that a sum of about £350,000 would be required to build a suitable hall. We were very pleasantly surprised when the government agreed to the idea. Raymond McGrath, the chief architect of the Office of Public Works, was entrusted with the work, and it was decided that Beggar's Bush Barracks would be a suitable site. Four architects were assisting Raymond McGrath, and they spent many years working on the project. Plans were drawn up, providing seating for 1,840 people, with additional accommodation, if necessary, for 200 more in the choir. The stage was to provide for orchestras of up to 120 players. There was also to be a smaller hall in the complex to seat 464. Now, that was the position in 1966.
It seemed that the dream had come true. Soon, everyone felt that the Radio Telefiche and Symphony Orchestra, as it now was called, would have that long-awaited home. But the 60s ended, and the project was still on the drawing board. The quantity surveyors in 1969 put the cost of the complex at £2.6 million, and still only plans and prices were produced.
In 1971, when Ireland won the Eurovision Song Contest, and when we were in search of a venue to stage the contest here in Dublin, one of the areas we thought of was the Great Hall in UCD.
George Waters, RTE's Director General, then a senior engineer with the organisation.
And at the time, I was responsible for finding this venue, and I wrote to Professor Michael Hogan, who was then chairman of the building committee in UCD. And I asked him if the college would be prepared to give the hall to RTE for the song contest. The building committee readily accepted our proposal, and they wrote to tell me so. We then costed the necessary changes that would have to be made to make it suitable for the song contest, because of course the Great Hall was acoustically very bad, very poor. And we discovered that the cost in effect ruled it out, and we ended up, as you know, with the Gaiety Theatre. But after the song contest, I wrote to Professor Hogan again and suggested that the Aula Maxima would make an ideal home for the symphony orchestra, and that when UCD were moving out of Earlsford Terrace, that they might keep RTE in mind.
the nettle was grasped by the then Minister for Finance, Richie Ryan.
By the early 70s, it was clear that, or the mid-70s, it was clear that the kind of money necessary to build that hall wasn't going to become available. And therefore, we took the decision that it was better to have a reasonable hall, a reasonable facility available, which would enable the Symphony Orchestra, which is a very good orchestra, to improve in reasonable conditions and to allow the public to enjoy the orchestra in such conditions. And that was the objective of the UCD Hall. We shouldn't call it that anymore, the Earlswood Terrace Hall, I suppose. And we're hopeful that this dream is going to be fulfilled now.
Project architect Michael O'Doherty and his team worked closely with acoustics expert Dr. Jordan from Copenhagen.
We developed a design on paper, and he took this then and built a model of it in his own studio in Denmark, a 1-to-10 scale model. And he carried out tests within the model with a sound source and various microphones set around the proposed seating areas. And at that stage, he was able to come back to us and say, well, look, this is working, and this requires it. This isn't working, this requires adjustment, and so forth. And we will have to have some reflectors over the choir area. Clarity isn't quite what it could be. So, right, we got back and made the changes then, went back to him, and he made the changes on the models, on the model, retested, and then he was able to say, okay, that looks good. That's
the hall itself is very close to the classical hall design, isn't it?
Well, it is. In fact, that hall is, I believe, the forerunner of the European concert hall of that period. It was built 10 years ahead of the Music Fire and Sound, Concertgebouw, most of the Leipzig Gewandhaus. So I feel this must be the forerunner of the very famous European halls.
It was in April of this year that a board of 12 directors was appointed to control the hall, under the chairmanship of Fred O'Donovan.
It's a wonderful board, I can safely say that. It's they're talented, they're interesting, and what we have done is on the board we form committees, an administration committee and an artistic committee, and the actual booking between now and Christmas was formulated by the artistic committee, and then our administrator, he negotiates fees. But basically, I think it's a better idea to have the artistic side of it controlled by a number of people rather than any one individual.
You don't get one taste too much.
Exactly,
then.
Because we all have personal tastes in music. I have a particular thing about young people. I feel that the youth of the country, I think we should help the youth orchestra. I think we should help the young singers, the up-and-coming soloists, because I feel that's where our future lies. I mean, the young 17, 18-year-olds, in 10 years' time, they'll be our stars. And I think they can only achieve that if people like our board and our concert hall help them.
The creation of the hall brings many new opportunities and hopes for Ireland's musicians and music lovers. Colman Pearce, the symphony orchestra's principal conductor.
In fact, I've been envious over the years of some of the halls that I've both listened in and worked in, and I think the orchestras that enjoy the good halls around Europe are so blessed. I think, for example, of the Musikverein in Vienna, the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. These are, of course, two of the absolute optimum halls in the world. Everybody loves the sound there. It's warm, it's resonant strings, sound, singing. Then the Boston Symphony Hall is the best one that I heard in the States. We're talking about top orchestras too here, you know, but it's like the chicken and the egg. One helps the other.
Stage one of the National Concert Hall has been to bring the building into operation, and this has been achieved in a very short time indeed. Now attention is being focused on the future. Administrator Lindsay Armstrong lists some of the activities the hall has in store for us.
I think there's a lot of very exciting things coming up. I think you'll appreciate that it's not easy to get big names at very short notice. And we've been particularly fortunate in our first season to get some extremely eminent artists. Now, I have a very good board, and they have been a great help to me in getting some of the best known artists in the world. For instance, we kick off with Rostropovich in October, 2nd and 3rd of October. Not only Rostropovich playing the cello, but his wife, Vishnevskaya, singing, and his daughter playing the piano. So that should be two memorable occasions, our very first celebrity recitals. Then we have the winner of the Leeds piano competitions coming a couple of weeks later, certainly a prize winner. Menuhin is appearing in November, and on his programme is the famous unaccompanied Bach partita, the one with the chaconne, which he is a splendid interpreter of. And I'm particularly looking forward to that because I do think he plays that piece marvellously. Gil Ells will be in December, an unusual programme, playing piano four hands with his daughter, which a wonderful Schubert programme, because some of the great masterpieces are of four-hand duets, so to speak, are by Schubert. We have Brendel, the marvellous Austrian pianist, in January. And I hope a complete change of orientation, if I can put it like that, Ravi Shankar in March of next year. I think Shankar's a great artist of his kind, and that will be a complete contrast to the kind of Western classical music. We'll be getting one of the finest exponents of Indian classical music on that. A very important event is the St. Matthew Passion that we're promoting on Palm Sunday, with a completely all-Irish cast, so to speak, Irish conductors, soloists, choirs. And I think that will be a major musical event.
The first work to be performed in the new hall was a specially commissioned choral composition by Saoirse Bodley, his Symphony No. 3, entitled Kyol.
On the one hand, you're writing a work for what is, in fact, a great occasion. There's no point in putting a tooth in, but just has to say that. And it's a great opportunity. On the other hand, one also has to write a work which is artistically viable. I don't really care myself for writing works that would be purely occasional, in the sense that we write for the occasion and that's it. So it was a matter of trying to find something that would fit both possibilities. And so, for instance, I tried to think of what might be the most basic musical statement that could be made, and that would fit in some way with a work, the theme of which is music itself, which I thought was suitable for a concert hall opening. And so I have the work starting, and indeed ending, with a long drawn out C major chord as being a sort of symbolic of the most basic possible musical statement one could make. Other than that, one also had to think how one would approach the text, because this is vital. And while the text, of course, is not by myself, it's by Brendan Kennelly, who's done a superb job on it, as one would expect. Nonetheless, we discussed this from the very beginning. And I felt that my original idea was to have references to Kyol, music in Irish, and to take them as a starting point, perhaps working from proverbs. But as I thought about it, and as we both discussed this, we gradually came more around to a slightly looser view than that, and took references to music from poetry, from Irish poetry, from proverbs indeed, or from particular sayings. And it's curious, when you put these all together, you suddenly realise that the word kyol in Irish means a thousand different things. You know, you can use it metaphorically. Mhiolhu, you are my music. Or directly, or as say in Neil Farren, Neil Tiasagam, Neil Fiantan of Kyol, I've neither land nor house, wine nor music. Or sometimes, in the case of two of the titles, they are in fact invented, so to speak, by ourselves. For instance, the one that ends the first movement on Kyol agus Naira, music and shame, and the last one, Kyol and Hyoil, the music of music.
Thank you.
part of Lychedochus with Bernadette Grevy. Kjoll was received with rapturous applause at the state opening, and the concert was broadcast not only throughout Ireland on television and radio, but was also relayed to a number of overseas countries, including Russia. A very distinguished audience was present, and these are just some of their comments. Here's Alpha O'Reilly and Maura Larsche.
They have managed to retain much of the innate quality of the original building and yet created a wonderful, cool sense of space and splendour. But just now I was very interested to hear, fascinated to hear, that what I thought were 13 elegant flying saucer type lighting panels in the roof, which I thought we didn't have turned on tonight because of being televised, are in fact acoustic panels. And I think it's a lovely bit of design that the acoustic panels become such a lovely feature. Normally they're a feature, but not a beautiful one. And they're like old green glass, and they're lovely, and I think people will be watching them like mad.
Maura, your family has a close relationship with music, and indeed your father was very much involved and actually played here many years ago, as he told us in a famous interview some years ago. Is this an exciting night for you?
It's a very exciting night, and I'm thinking of him a lot. He would have been so thrilled with the whole thing. It's such a beautiful hall. They've done a wonderful job on it. And of course, he would have remembered concerts here when it was, what was it called then?
The Royal University then.
Yes, I think he would have been very thrilled, and he would have been particularly thrilled with his pupil Saoirse Bodley's splendid piece.
Well, I found it more than exciting, actually. I think it was absolutely marvellous, and I was particularly impressed with the Saoirse Bodley. It was really invigorating.
As somebody who's had problems in finding venues and looking for places to perform music in over the years, is this going to make a big difference to Musical Dublin?
Oh, I think so. It's got all the elegance that you want, and it's a fine hall, and I think the acoustics seem to be very good indeed. It's just what we want. It may be a little bit small from audience size, but I think it's very good.
And that was Ronald Twelve Trees, and here's Siobhan McKenna.
It's one of the great evenings in the history of Dublin, isn't it, really? When I came up from Galway years ago, one would go to the old Capitol for concerts and things like that. But tonight really is a triumph, and everyone was so wonderful, and it's such a beautiful building. I'm really very moved. I think it's just a great, great evening, and I would like to say congratulations to everyone concerned. And I loved the new piece, you know, of music. It was wonderfully exciting. Great evening.
Not alone was the Kjoll or the music extremely satisfying, but the whole occasion. I think it's a wonderful night for music in Dublin. I think it's a wonderful night for music in Ireland. I think it'll lift the whole scene for music in this country.
As a regular amateur player yourself, will this be a very important fillip for the whole amateur scene as well?
Oh, I think so. And I mean, I hope as a regular amateur player that amateurs like myself, provided the standard is professional enough, that we get an opportunity to go out on that stage and to give of our music in that magnificent acoustic.
That's Shea Cleary, and this is Mrs. Rita Childers.
Very, very exciting for me, particularly as it seemed to be my husband's dream come true, and the only vacant seat in the balcony was beside me, and I felt he was there because everyone kept saying how wonderful it is. Was since way back when he was Minister of Posts and Telegraphs, when Symphony Orchestra was being formed in 1952 to 55 or 6, this was his dream, that when the Symphony Orchestra was formed, that there would be a concert hall for them to play in, and it went as far back as that. And I felt he was beside me tonight and greatly thrilled.
This is a dream come true for many of us. We never thought we would see it in our lifetime, that it was a concert hall, and now we'll be able to invite international artists and musicians to come here and play in a properly equipped concert hall, and not a makeshift hall as in the old days.
Comments there by Dermot Doolan, and here's Dame Ruth King.
Nobody could fail to be happy with an event like tonight, the opening of a great concert hall, which the people of Ireland and this capital city really deserve. It is beautiful to be in. The whole ambiance of the place is lovely, it's restful, it's artistic. It makes the atmosphere right for whatever takes part in the hall. And tonight to have an Irish composer with an original piece, a piece of a kind that one wouldn't hear anywhere else but in Ireland, and then to hear one of the greatest works of all time and linking us with Europe, and a huge performance, and to do it in a new hall before anybody's really used to the sound and the acoustics was a great achievement.
I also asked Pat O'Kelly, who's a much-travelled music critic and chairman of the Music Association, for his reactions.
I think they can only be favourable when one considers what we have endured for a long time in Dublin, the Gaiety Theatre, which was not acoustically particularly good, but a very friendly place to sit in. We endured Francis Xavier Hall. I think familiarity made us like it. I don't think it had a very great acoustic sound. So going to the new hall and hearing really the RTSO for the first time in Dublin, the experience was quite enlightening. At the acoustic test, I found I couldn't hear the lower strings particularly well. I found they were being swamped a lot of the time. I was sitting in the stalls. The next night I was invited along to hear the orchestra again with the choir, and I sat upstairs and found the sound to be somewhat improved, but there again the lower strings weren't coming through. And I'm a little disappointed to find on Wednesday at the opening that this problem does seem to exist. Now whether that can be overcome, I don't know. Maybe it's the orchestra themselves haven't actually found their own positions, insofar as maybe they're not used to hearing themselves in these surroundings yet. This is a problem will take time, I'm sure, to sort out.
So, where do we head from here? Because, of course, this is only the beginning of the hall, not the end of the whole adventure. Here's Lindsay Armstrong.
Every night of the week, something good going on at the National Concert Hall. And maybe matinees as well.
Gerard Victory.
My main ambition would be, I think, to see it grow in further servicing and some other facilities. It will have very good practical servicing facilities and for the public. I think that's all very well known. But what I'd like to see is that it becomes a cultural centre.
Olive Smith.
I now feel I can really lay down my pen and all the rest of it and leave it. And another intriguing thing about it is that after all these years that I slaved at it, now the manager of the concert hall is my son-in-law, and he, I think, is going to find it pretty tough going to begin with.
And George Waters.
I think it's going to be a great morale boost for the orchestra and indeed for RTE music department as a whole, and not before its time, I should say.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.